LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Listen without limits. Unchain your brain. Change your thinking. Change your life. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host, Greg Moffat, and today we present part two of our interview with James Tunney, Resisting Artificial Intelligence and the Technocratic Takeover. The small section of patchy audio at the end of part one has been restored and is included here at the start.
You have a choice to fulfill your spiritual consciousness or a choice to reset it, if you like, or you don't. You're still in the same position. If you're in the happy position that you have done that already, well, you're not. Your life may not be as affected so much. In relation to the intervention from on the basis of geological or other forces, that will affect most the people who have invested all their world in the technology, because that's the thing that's going to be affected, and the people who haven't will be in a better position. So there is a flow in the games that's going to happen. On the cosmic game, those factors will play out in favor of people who have spiritual consciousness. In my belief, the superior spiritual realms assist that movement, and that's what ultimately the lesser manipulative, controlling, baser elements with all that, whatever demonic power, if you like, will fail in those terms. But you don't have control over those issues, but you do have control over your life and your choices. And it's whether one passes into what is an illusion as opposed to a dream, illusory sense of reality, insubstantial, a fantasy of who we are. That's the dangerous issue of departing from the idea of who we really are, which is the same issue again and again and again, which is something we have control over.
So, thinking in terms of resistance, physical resistance, again, in itself, if not informed by its spiritual dimension, then limited in scope and power. But in tyrannies and dictatorships and dystopias of the past, you often have what we have now, you know, a pyramidal structure to society, to the system, you know, with elites, controllers at the top, and functionaries, people who cart away your trash and all of that at the bottom. And then somewhere up the pyramid, beyond middle management, you have a layer of enforcers. These can be your politicians. Often as not, they're people at the coal face of this sort of thing. I'm talking about police now, or paramilitary forces, or indeed the army, whatever it happens to be, the people who get mobilized when things kick off in the streets. And depending on which part of the world you live in, that could just be the police with a few batons, maybe a water cannon, or it can be full-on armed forces, you know, shooting war response, people get killed. But many of these stories, real world and fictional, there comes a point when the enforcers, if not put down their weapons, then just walk away because they just think this is just not worth it. This is not working for us anymore. We're here fighting people, suppressing people who are the same as us in the name of people who are somewhere above us and don't care about us. But what does that idea of that layer of the pyramid being pulled away and the whole thing collapsing, how does that change in the technological landscape that we're in and increasing, you know, getting deeper into? Is there a point when the enforcers walk away, or do we look at the enforcers themselves being replaced technologically? You know, whether it is control and surveillance systems, or you see in the most frothy end of techno enthusiasm for these things, robots, soldiers and robot dogs and all sorts of things out, armed and out there. And well, they're not human and they're dispensable, and whoever's doing this can just keep manufacturing more of them. And you can't argue with them. It's the RoboCop idea, I suppose, or the Terminator.
Well, the first thing they're doing is dehomogenizing nation states so that, for example, the people in Ireland who are not going to be governed at the top by police that are Irish, and that's a way that it's done, that you decapitate the structure so that you can, achieve different aims which are inconsistent with the needs of the people, for example. This is a standard thing. So that difference issue. There is a difference issue. They will people, the police force, are doing it quite clearly now with people from different countries, different cultures, and probably give reasons for them to hate the people that are there, to lever the differences on the basis of political struggles, on the basis of cultivation of war. One, in relation to foreign policy, one of the I wasn't a critic of Trump. I didn't have that derangement syndrome. But the one issue, two issues I would point out that I don't like about him. I don't like his plan to use the military to distribute vaccines. That was unbelievable. And also, he seems intent on war with Iran, and that's just an agenda issue. So we can cultivate all these kind of wars that will lead to divide and conquer. And we've seen how that strategy works in Northern Ireland, and you've seen it, Greg. And that is a strategy of power. So they're going to get the people to fight among themselves while they continue. As well as that, they have a more decentralized automatic system of governance, which I've talked about, the plantation of the automaton. So that helps them. But if you don't know who they are, the people don't have to walk away in many senses. And if we're not looking in the right places, and if they're misdirecting who's responsible for all this, which is why, again, the analysis of the system has to be critical. And the speed at which they're going to move, I think, is another factor, that they believe that the technological power, the pharmaceuticals, and the ability to control genes on a mass scale through these networks that they've established will enable them to do things very, very quickly and to experiment very, very quickly. So it's a new type of totalitarianism. And in a totalitarian system, it's not the police force that's enforcing the law, it's your neighbor. It's the person that lives down the stairs, because they will be subject to the propaganda system, and they will do what they are told. They are tentacles of the system as well, and everyone is connected to the network. Everyone is influenced by this. It's the AI is governance systems are more effective. So this human thing is going to be hard to generate unless we have generated the belief in humanity itself or regenerated that. So, especially when you use this hygiene thing, where you get a load of people in your military who are working with the machines, who have this sense of power, and who have been programmed to see particular groups as particularly dirty in a deep psychological sense, where they have a deep phobic kind of hatred of them, the disease spreaders, etc. We can mix all these things up so that we can have people running these systems that are so afraid of their life that they will do anything that the machine tells them. And the network is getting so comprehensive because we are assisting the network get so comprehensive that we haven't experienced anything like this. It's a new problem. Ultimately, absent intervention of a divine or a natural manner, the only way this is going to be solved is by taking control of the controllers of the total system, and that will require a mass movement, a universal mass movement. I think we're in the totalitarian foothills already. So the global thing, we're not going backwards. We're not going back, absent some other big intervention. To the way we used to live. So we're going to have to look at the universals and begin to look at modes of of cooperation. So there's nothing, there's been nothing like this system. They have all the benefits of the previous system. So it's a new super duper improved totalitarian system, utilizing all the skills that they've learned over hundreds of years. And you, in one of your talks, I remember referring to William Sargent and his work. And that is very, very important, that kind of thinking, again, coming out of London in relation to control of the mind, possession of the mind, and how you intervene medically in relation to controlling the mind. They have so much knowledge now, and they can do things on such a mass scale that the resistance will take some time to mobilize. It's going to be utterly different type of resistance. It will have to be non-violent, and it will have to be persuasive. Starting off with a violent solution is not going to work, because that's what they've planned for most. It will have to be of a different order. It will have to be of a different domain. It will have to be one which is persuasive to the people in the system, which is why it's important not to be drawn into bad tactics. For example, by seeing some person, because they belong to a group, as immediately against you. This is what their purpose is. So we have to look at the human first and a common spirituality. The spiritual people of whatever domain ultimately will begin to coalesce together and transcend their boundaries for this purpose, because they're facing an existential crisis. So therefore, we're going to have to advocate and promote different ways of seeing, whereby the resistance is an act of emergence from the chrysalis itself. It's an act of evolution. My whole analysis started off by saying that there has been a certain failure of spiritual evolution, and that's the basis of all the issues. By the same token, the cure comes from where the poison is. The solution is based on us increasing our spiritual evolution, increasing our modes of engagement with each other, whereby others understand and begin to remember who they are in this struggle. So we're going to have to rethink the nature of how one resists in this new context.
Well, one thing that's been rumbling for decades now, but it's been not reaching a crescendo, certainly been stepped up a great deal in the early 21st century, is this idea of toxic masculinity and traditional gender roles and all of that, the nuclear family and all that having to be scrapped in the name of diversity and inclusion. And what that boils down to me is in terms of we're talking about resistance here, is this, discouragement, this dilution of natural aggression. And by that, I mean intelligently directed. You mentioned martial arts like aggression channeled and directed with intent and intelligence at a particular target. And I remember reading, I mentioned this before in this context also, to you, E.M. Forster's The Machine Stops.
Yes.
His prescient novel written in the 1920s, and that talks about weak physical specimens and the idea that any newborn in that system that shows any type of aggression or strength or whatever is immediately just exterminated because those qualities are no longer required. There's just no need for it. And we want to live in societies where aggression is at a minimum because it's not called for, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Or it's protective, or it's providing something, like I don't know, killing an animal for food. There's a certain amount of aggression involved with that. But all of that leads me to think about, and I think you used the word techno rebels in your current book, but this idea of there being, and again, I'm talking on a physical level here, resistance to the system and how that is weakened and watered down by a lack of, call it aggression if you will, but just sort of any kind of energy or drive to do something about a situation that people find themselves in that has, I say again, once again, if that's informed by a spiritual dimension, then it's so much stronger. But of course, that kind of, if we look at, say, that's a practical everyday example, current in London in particular at the minute, you have these surveillance cameras being installed to enforce ultra low emission zone rules about traffic movement, you know, which cars can come and go, all of it in the name of net zero and a green agenda. And you have, interestingly enough, they're being dubbed, I don't know if it's by themselves, but as Blade Runners. And these are people, maybe mostly guys, I don't know. And they're going around vandalizing and destroying these cameras. And it looks quite well organized and a lot of damage has been done, but they're just being portrayed as like knuckle draggers. They're anti-science, they're anti-progress, they're not the future, they're the past, they're criminals. And then if we think about science fiction, as I like to look at, you know, through a sci-fi lens at the issues we're facing, you know, in Terminator, as I mentioned earlier, particularly in Terminator 2, you see them talking about how John Connor taught them to smash the machines, you know, taught them to fight back against seemingly insurmountable technological odds. And in Fight Club, which we mentioned off air, Tyler Durden's character and his Project Mayhem was very much the same agenda, you know, disrupting the system, you know, through asymmetrical attacks. One last thing I'll mention in this context is, you know, moving away from fiction. Last time we talked about the writer Theodore Roszak. Well,
Yes.
another Theodore that looms large in terms of techno rebels, Ted Kaczynski, you know, the infamous
Yes.
Unabomber. And I was reading up again on him the other day. And again, you know, you and I are not sitting here advocating violence. All I'm saying is really that as presaged in sci-fi, and as we're seeing now, there is going to be violence, whether the people are involved with it are in any way spiritually informed or not. There is going to be violence. A lot of it will actually be destructive on both sides. Some of it will play into the hands of the transhumanists and the technocratic players. There's no doubt about that. But we only have to look at the news, if you can bear to now, around these issues. There's going to be increasing violence, and you said yourself about that not being generally an appropriate response. Nonetheless, we can expect to see more of this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm only stating my own position. If you ask me as a predictor in relation to social context, there's no question about that. That will, and on, you know, as it becomes clearer what's happening, some people are going to get very angry, and that will happen. All I'm saying is that in relation to a mass movement, and one that I'm going to be, anyone I would encourage, I don't encourage violence because, in a historical context, in my family, there have been members of parliament numerous occasions close to me, members of the IRA, the Irish Republican, going back a long time. The problem, even with those secret societies, is they can be taken over and they can be misused, and that's what happened with the IRA in Northern Ireland. And they were taken over by communists, basically, that the Catholics didn't understand. And history will focus on that a bit more. And but also, if I go back to my grandfather's time, he was involved in the land movement, and it was in Mayo and Roscommon that they developed the notion of the boycott. It came from there, and they applied. Going back to the time Parnell, they applied ideas of interpersonal boycotts that were very, very effective. So, what they began to do was they simply shunned people that were participating in the system that was oppressing them. Now, the power of that is it's non-violent, but it also directly affects on a deep and quick and effective way these systems that are oppressing. And it will happen that a lot of these politicians now in the Judas generation will be shunned in the future when people begin to understand what they were participating in, when they begin to see how they were involved in this system and they planned this system. Now, again, I don't advocate violence against people, so I'm careful about, and I don't point fingers. I certainly could, but I'm not going to do so. It's about the fact that, funny enough, the things that are most powerful are deep-seated elements of our psychology, which the other people still have. Even the psychopaths have to deal with those issues if they're faced with them in relation to, on a strategic way, in relation to how they negotiate the world. All of these people oppressing us, the whole network, have to live in this environment that we all live in. They haven't mastered escaping from the earth yet, which they plan to do. And even if they do, I don't think that it will be very effective on a mass scale for them. So the whole point is that there are elite groups that have within them the potential to be deconstructed from the outside through explaining what's going on. And this will happen. There will be elite defection. There will be people inside. There will be more whistleblowers. There will be more people that see that what the critics are saying is true and that realize there's no future for them and there's no future for their children or grandchildren or whatever. And there will also be, very, very possibly, something like a cull of the politicians from their bosses. This happens throughout history when the fools that they have used and the useful idiots and done the dirty work, they want to get rid of them because they will reveal secrets about them and they are dangerous and they didn't want them. They were useful fools for them when they were achieving on the way up. So all those things are going to happen. But what I'm most interested in is the individual, what they do and what their behavior, how that can begin to translate. I've used the idea. So we have to distinguish between the analysis of the situation, the philosophical base, and then strategy and tactics. And this domain now is about organization. The organization that's going to ultimately combat this will be a non-organization, as I've talked about before, about an invisible army, a secret army, a non-army, if you like, of people who are sufficiently informed about what's going on, but will be able on a mass scale to intervene in the system because the system requires human interventions on a mass scale. There will always be weaknesses. And in this context, the most effective strategy is not a Yang strategy going out facing the bigger thing. That was one of the reasons why they adopted guerrilla war techniques in Ireland and developed some of them in urban warfare techniques because there was an asymmetry. It will be a different method. And so in the Taoist terms, this movement is going to be a yin movement. So the yin movement is the basic philosophy of judo, really, although judo is Japanese, the gentle way. It's about utilizing weakness and maximizing the application of minimum pressure to strategic points to destabilize the enemy, for example. And that's that. So there's ideas there, so like kazushi and balance breaking, for example. So a thing looks very big and we can destabilize it. So, but that's a soft strategy. And associated with that is also a mental attitude. One of the problems with this agenda they have is their success in creating a paralyzing fear. And we have to be careful not to be paralyzed by fear. And if you notice all this like trash talk, if you like, in kind of the reason why they do that in boxing or in MMA, and the reason why Conor McGregor, for example, would engage in his trash talk, is that he knows that if he can get a person annoyed, their muscles begin to stiffen. They get stiff. They don't have the same flexibility. Whereas as he's relaxed, he has a much more mobility and much more speed. So there are effects to their fear, and there are effects also to us being relaxed. So consistent with a soft, a gentle yin strategy, a diffuse strategy, is the power of softness. And the Tao Te Ching explains there's a fundamental principle in ancient philosophy. Softness overcomes hardness. It's critical. It's a critical insight from watching the way water wears away stone. Softness indicate or will overcome the hardness. It will wear away the stone. They learned this from practical observation. So softness comes through things like the truth and analysis and kindness as well as a useful. Apart from the inherent nature of kindness, it's also an effective strategy. I'm not saying it should be ever reduced to that, but if we begin to recognize the other, excuse me, in a general sense, we begin to establish genuine solidarity as opposed to a notional cultivated solidarity. I know I could give you examples. I won't go through the whole detail, but I got out of very difficult situations on a few occasions that where the odds would have been against me in a practical situation when I was in London working in pubs and that, merely because I had talked to people just politely over a period of time. And I could explain how that works sometimes, but it was really because of the exercise of basic values of human interaction and respect and manners at a basic level that a relationship came out that was useful in a more dangerous context. So the soft values are very, very important. It's not that you be soft. In order to be effective in that judo context, you have to be very, very determined and very, very focused. So I'm not talking about getting rid of the motivation that drove those fellows out to pick up guns and to fight against whoever they were fighting against, the British Empire in that context, with a very, very clear sense of who they were fighting against. I'm not talking about that and going to prison and being tortured and all that kind of stuff. And one of my father's uncles, I think I mentioned, he was in Frangok with Terence McSweeney. That was 74 days on hunger strike and died. And it was a cause célèbre around the world that influenced Gandhi and other people. So they were involved in deep strategic and tactical thinking. But on this level, we have to think in a different domain, in a different world, and we have to excuse me, think in a way that they haven't anticipated. And as I've talked about the murmuration, the idea that as birds fly together, one bird will influence seven around them. So you don't have centralization. You can't have a capture of the head of it because there isn't a head of it really, or you won't find out what the head of it is. The thing can respond itself organically without central organization. And it will do so from self-incentive and from ability to able to identify other beings of its own nature. In our case, it's identifying other humans who don't want to be enslaved. And there is this crossover. I mentioned before that Bruce Lee's philosophy was largely inspired by Krishnamurti. So he's an example of someone who has taken a spiritual tradition or a spiritual attitude and implemented it into his philosophy of martial arts. So all his expressions, like be like, well, he said be like water as well, the uncontainability of it, reflects as well this idea of having no method that Krishnamurti advocated. That's why Bruce Lee believed that you shouldn't compartmentalize yourself by one style, and you should take from other styles. Now, a lot of people don't like that, but it's kind of consistent with the philosophy of MMA and how that has proved effective against the mystical things that don't work. And I've also studied a lot Gene Tunney, who was a distant relation, who was useful. He was only beaten once in his career, a guy he subsequently beat, Harry Greb, and so his record is astounding. And a lot of his power, well, came from training and various types of training and anticipating the enemy. He anticipated, for example, that he could get knocked down against Dempsey. So he ran backwards. He could run 3 miles backwards. And in the Dempsey fight, when he was knocked down, he got up and backpedaled for a long time until he recovered. And that was because he'd practiced for so long. But his particular strength came from studying his enemy by understanding how they were going to behave. So he would, for example, he would spot. He was one of the first that used videos in or film in analysis of his opponent, and he knows one fellow that was a good boxer. I forget his name that had a knockout punch, and but he noticed that when he had a knockout punch, he'd move his left foot back an inch. So he spent the first five rounds waiting, just watching for the foot to move back an inch, and then he knew what was coming and he could counter it. So that's what we call a tell, something that tells you something. And when you're doing your hauntology, what I hear in it is there's tells in this. The system is telling us something. It's giving information about itself, and that's why I find your series so useful, that we can learn about thinking that was in the system that it may have forgotten about. There's a vast repertoire of signals from the military industrial complex embedded in popular culture that we can interpret in order to, excuse me, interpret some of the things. So I don't believe, when I'm saying softness, I'm not talking about men becoming effeminate or anything like that. If people want, that's up to themselves. Interestingly, if you look at the process, if you look at the criminalization of gay people and the Labouchere Amendment in 1885, the one that Oscar Wilde was prosecuted in under, the one that led to a lot of prosecution. The reason why there was prosecution, nothing got to do with religion, nothing got to do with the church, as a lot of people believe. It was got to do with the empire struggling between themselves and theories of evolution, which led to a quasi-scientific belief that effeminate men wouldn't be able to defend the empire, which is interesting. You don't hear that now. But that was the reason. It wasn't a religious reason, as is usually misrepresented. Of course, the reason they have to get rid of the nation state, the family, and religion, which is another tactical reason. I don't like hearing people in the alternative community making arguments that they have promoted, that reduce the history, say, of Christianity, when it's in the interest of the Scientocracy that wants to control us. So I advocate a very robust but clear, focused analysis that enables people to respond and also to think of strategy. There are many ancient books on strategy in military context. There's the famous 36 stratagems, which goes back hundreds of years, which explains different stratagems to be used in battle and different psychological ruses or ploys or deceptions or to sacrifice the plum tree to save the peach tree, for example. You have to give up certain things in order to protect bigger things. That's why I don't like people in the alternative community wanting everything. They won't cede things. They will judge everything. They'll have a view on everything. And sometimes that view is not helpful to in a tactical sense. So some of those things can only be refined through people thinking in a clearer way, through looking at the history of strategy, because they're using strategy against us. If you take, for example, one of the main bodies, the Fabian Society is defined by its strategy. And Blair was a member of that. He's always talking about strategy. And it's quite incredible that he's there still wanting to bring in the IDE system, that he's still involved in it. But the Fabian Society, of course, was dependent on the Roman general who was successful by avoiding confrontation and to in their case, to be able to avoid a battle until they were in a strong position. And that defined the Fabian strategy of going under the radar and being undercover, and they also had a symbol of the tortoise to move slowly. Excuse me. So they use strategy, and people that are opposing them sometimes don't know what the philosophy is. Sometimes they don't know what the history is. Sometimes they can't distinguish between a strategy and a tactic that they're using. And if they can't do that, if they can't identify the enemy properly, if they can't identify what their aims are, if they can't identify what their methods are, if they can't identify their strategy and tactics, well, then they're not able to identify any counter strategy. My suggestion is that ultimately, the water yin soft diffuse strategy of a mass scale, decentralized, which is impossible to police, impossible to predict, which is based on influence and alignment on a voluntary basis between individual humans across cultural boundaries, utilizing their human skills and their spiritual consciousness and awareness and alignment in that way, will be able to ultimately combat this system.
That concludes part one of our interview. Part two will be available soon in the subscribers area at legalizefreedom.com.
Legalizefreedom.com.